Imam Khomeini is also mentioning, is also using the same tradition to prove that how important is unity. And that's why he says that as long as you maintain your unity, God is with you. So God is with those who are united. If we have unity, then we know that the enemies cannot harm us. We know that no one can separate us from each other. No one can bring a dispute amongst us. If we are united, we are powerful. No one can even think about, you know, attacking or harming us. But if we are not united, if we are divided, then they can easily control over every single group which is in division. Every single group that is divided, it's very easy to get control. Maybe if we are not united, they can easily remove us. They can even harm us. So therefore, Imam Khomeini, when he is talking about the Muslim Ummah, being the leader of Muslim Ummah, he talks about unity. Why? Because he wants to bring the grounds, he wants to make the grounds of the reappearance of Imam of the time, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Being a Muslim, we all believe that Imam Mahdi is the leader of the whole Muslim Ummah. Therefore, we need to be united before his reappearance.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, our program aims to address the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the US offer of humanitarian assistance to crisis-stricken Afghanistan and what it means in the context of America's 20-year-long adventurism. And we shall discuss a major crackdown by authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir in response to recent killings of the members of minority community.
Reports suggest that the Biden administration has agreed to provide aid to Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, which is staring at a major humanitarian crisis. On the face of it, the gesture appears to be altruistic in nature, but on dissecting the issue, it becomes clear that the catastrophe itself has been manufactured by the U.S. military-industrial complex. Even before Taliban's dramatic takeover in August, the country was grappling with economic recession, drought and the COVID crisis. And then came the freezing of assets and aid by the US and its European allies, which plunged the country into an unimaginable crisis.
In a classic case of manufacturing a crisis and then play-acting to resolve it, Americans have reportedly agreed to deliver financial aid to crisis-stricken Afghanistan, while refusing to politically recognize Taliban's caretaker government. It came after first direct talks between the two sides early October in Doha, nearly 2 months after the chaotic withdrawal of US troops from the war-ravaged country. While the U.S. government has stopped short of officially announcing the aid, after two meetings with the Taliban officials, the European Union has pledged $1.5 billion in aid to Afghanistan and to neighboring countries, without specifying how it will reach the ordinary Afghans. It comes as decisions on whether to officially recognize the Taliban government and whether to unfreeze nearly $10 billion in Afghanistan's national assets held by the U.S. Federal Reserve have been effectively put on the back burner. The U.S. government blocked the access to Afghan assets immediately after the Taliban laid siege to Kabul on August 15th. 2 days later, the European Union also suspended its long-term projects in the country, leaving millions of Afghans at the risk of major humanitarian catastrophe. Since then, International Monetary Fund, as well as the World Bank, have stopped disbursing money to the country. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has warned of make-or-break moment for Afghanistan, with the economic institutions slowly breaking down. The U.S. officials, however, remain indifferent to the crisis they helped create.
The full-blown humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan did not unfold overnight. It has been in the making since the U.S.-led coalition forces invaded the country 20 years ago. On the pretext of nation-building, the foreign powers destroyed the country, fanned the flames of war, and eventually beat a hasty and humiliating retreat. Having failed to help Afghanistan become self-reliant over the past two decades, the U.S. and its allies are now strangulating the country by freezing its assets. At the same time, it's hoodwinking the international community by making flimsy promises of humanitarian assistance.
Under the previous U.S.-backed government in Kabul, around 43% of the South Asian country's GDP came from foreign aid, according to the World Bank. But still, as the former President Ashraf Ghani himself admitted in July 2020, 90% of the country's population lives below the poverty line, with less than $2 daily income. A report by the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in January 2021 noted that around 18.4 million people in Afghanistan, nearly half of the population, were in need of humanitarian assistance, six times more than 4 years ago. These horrifying statistics were published before the Taliban made sweeping advances across the country, and at a time when the US-led coalition was firmly in control. So, the question everyone is asking is, what happened to the $2.26 trillion the U.S. claims to have spent in Afghanistan since 2001? Did it vanish into thin air? Before the Americans and European froze Afghanistan's assets in August, they had for years enabled rampant corruption, filling the coffers of those who pledged loyalty to them. This gross misappropriation of funds was even acknowledged by the top U.S. oversight body. So, the news about U.S. or even Europeans offering aid to the country now should be taken with a grain of salt.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Mr. Ryan Dawson, an author and geopolitical analyst. Mr. Dawson, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's very important.
Now, as we've seen, Americans and Europeans have pledged aid to crisis-stricken Afghanistan 2 months after hastily abandoning the country. Now, do you think this so-called assistance should be seen with a measure of skepticism?
Well, certainly, prudence would show that there should be skepticism toward this aid. Now, this has been ongoing even before the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. All throughout the 80s, the United States had intervened in Afghanistan allegedly to fight the Soviets, and they had aided different factions, and there's never any result from this aid, and they used it as a bargaining chip. They used food aid, for example, which they would take away if they didn't get the political results that they wanted. And so this aid doesn't come without consequences. Hillary Clinton is infamous for cutting off food aid, which forced factions in Afghanistan to start selling opium again out of desperation which led to more drug cartels and nefarious things. Of course, during the occupation of Afghanistan, and that's what it was, when they annexed it for 20 years, the U.S. was protecting poppy fields. But that revenue didn't go back to Afghanistan. That revenue went to intelligence agencies, and which was used as black budgets to finance terrorist groups like ISIS in Syria.
Now, Mr. Dawson, it was the U.S. government that initiated the talks with the Taliban last year without taking the Kabul government on board. So why is Washington now justified in freezing $10 billion U.S. dollars of Afghan assets?
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't part of the negotiations. Of course, there's different administrations. So the Trump government sat down and had negotiations with the Taliban. The Taliban did stop attacks on U.S. targets, and the U.S. stopped attacking the Taliban. So there was peace in Afghanistan so long as people upheld the agreement. Nowhere was it said, oh, later after we leave, we're going to freeze all your assets because you're not the government we really want. We were hoping the Afghan nationals that we are supporting were going to. It shouldn't be up to the United States to decide which government is in Afghanistan or not, first of all. It's not up to an outside power. That's supposed to be up to the people of Afghanistan. And when it's not, even within their civil war, what have you, the U.S. cannot be picking winners and losers in this, which it tried to do. And for 20 years, they wasted trillions of dollars, trillions with a T. Imagine if they spent a fraction of that on actually helping people in Afghanistan through charities or third parties, something that's not government. But that's not what happened. But they made a deal with the Taliban, and then the administrations did change. But I don't know if the old administration would have upheld the deal either. But as it is, the Biden admin comes in, reneges on the deals they made, and says, we're going to freeze $10 billion. Why do they even control that much is another question, but they're going to freeze their assets. Now, they can do it based on power and based on the bully pulpit. But if you're asking, can they do that? Yeah, they can. They have the ability to. Should they be allowed to do that? Of course not.
Mr. Dawson, one last question. Now Afghanistan is today staring at a humanitarian crisis or catastrophe. Do you think part of the blame should be shared by the U.S. and its European allies?
They are partly to blame, but they left weapons caches out for whomever. And their behavior, first of all, is an act of terrorism when you take a drone and murder a family of 10. Which finally got a lot of news attention, the final drone strike that took out a family, mostly children. That is an act of terrorism, and it also creates acts of terrorism as a backlash. And the drone policy and much of the house raiding policy and the double tap policy that they kept for 20 years in Afghanistan, which mainly did kill civilians, and in my opinion is terrorism itself, it's high-tech terrorism, will beget terrorism as a response. People who didn't hate or even know about the United States before is going to hate them now. Weapons of mass destruction that we say no one else is allowed to have, but that are used, cluster bombs and napalm and MK-77 and MOABs that the military did deploy in Afghanistan at some points, they kill indiscriminately. And they had very bad intelligence where, you know, one tribe would say, yeah, that's the bad guys over there, and it's just their own personal enemies, and the U.S. would run around, attack that one, and then, oh, oops, and then rinse and repeat. And then they had lots of green-on-blue attacks, too. They need to just, they don't have the intelligence that was proven, so they can't do a good job of this. They engaged in acts of terrorism, whether they meant to or not. You know, if you drone strike the wrong car and end up killing a family because you got bad intel, it doesn't matter to that family. And let's be honest, this is not just all incompetence. You do that a few times in the first year, you need to sort that out. And they never did. For a generation, they murdered people over there. So that is terrorism. And of course, it's going to create terrorists. But in their minds, they won't think of themselves as terrorists. They'll think of, I'm avenging my family. Well, certainly they've had a role in the humanitarian crisis. I mean, they supported drug lords selling opium, who became the little fiefdoms in their valleys. not the best people to be in charge. And a lot of the healing that Afghanistan may have been able to do has been impossible because they've been in perpetual war for the last 30 years, really, including the Soviet occupations and then the U.S. occupation. That cycle of violence prevents the things that may have occurred in peacetime.
Mr. Dawson, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on this issue.
Madia Benjamin, author and founder of Code Pink, warns that if the US and World Bank do not release frozen Afghan funds, people in the crisis-stricken country will starve. Entrepreneur and freelance translator Noor Ahmed says $1 billion in aid cannot be a substitute for nearly $10 billion assets frozen by the US, demanding release of the money. Steve Hank, economist at Johns Hopkins University, points to corruption in Afghanistan fueled by foreign aid, says the country is at the brink of collapse despite billions of dollars in funding.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The situation continues to be fragile in the Indian-administered Kashmir after a fresh crackdown by the Indian security forces in early October, detaining over 700 people. It came in response to the killing of seven civilians, four of them members of the minority Hindu and Sikh communities. The cold-blooded killings have sparked anger and outrage across the Himalayan region, with the majority Muslim community unequivocally condemning it. However, many believe the police action against the members of the community smacks of abuse of power.
The summer capital of the Indian-administered Kashmir, Srinagar, was rocked by three back-to-back killings on October 5th. The first attack targeted a well-known pharmacist from the minority Kashmiri Hindu community. The second attack resulted in the killing of a non-local Hindu street hawker. The third attack killed a Muslim civilian. Barely 2 days later, unidentified gunmen barged inside a government school on the city outskirts, killing two teachers, a Sikh and a Hindu. In a separate but similar incident, two Muslim civilians were also shot dead. The spate of killings has sent shockwaves across the Himalayan Valley and sparked fear and unease among the minority communities. However, despite leading the condemnations, members of the majority Muslim community are again under the scanner. A massive crackdown by the Indian police has resulted in the arrest of around 700 people, mostly Muslims. The families of those arrested say the authorities are looking for scapegoats to hide their inability to protect the religious minorities. The sweeping action against local Kashmiri Muslims is seen as part of the controversial policy adopted by the BJP government in New Delhi since the abrogation of region's semi-autonomy status in August 2019. Pertinently, the attacks were claimed by a little-known group allegedly affiliated with the Pakistan-based militant outfit Lashkar-e-Toiba.
Following the revocation of Kashmir's special status under the Indian Constitution on August 5, 2019, New Delhi peddled a narrative of peace and normalcy, claiming that tourism has replaced terrorism in the Troubled Valley. But nothing could be farther from the truth. In the past 2 years, since 2019, not only have incidents of terrorism seen an alarming surge, authorities have used stringent measures to stifle dissent, detain political activists, intimidate journalists, and prevent political activities. In the process, the majority Muslim community has borne the brunt.
On August 4, 2019, close to 6,000 Kashmiri politicians, activists, journalists, and ordinary youth were arrested. Internet was suspended and a blanket curfew was imposed. It was a precursor to measures taken the next day when the disputed region's semi-autonomy status was revoked and the state was bifurcated into two union territories. The region remained under a communications lockdown for more than a year, even as unrest was quietly brewing. India's far-right BJP government claimed that peace and normalcy has returned, while rights activists decried arbitrary arrests of activists, silencing of journalists, and draconian colonial-era laws for critical social media posts. 2 years on, arbitrary detentions continue, public assembly is still banned, and thousands of youth remain in jails, including minors. Social media vigilantism has led to dismissal of dozens of government employees, while critical reportage by journalists has got them summons and arrests under repressive laws. While Kashmiri Muslims have borne the brunt of Indian government's post-August 2019 Kashmir policy, they have also been turned into scapegoats for security failures. The detention of over 700 Kashmiri Muslims 2 weeks ago and killing of a Muslim youth in South Kashmir this week, apparently in response to recent civilian killings, follows the same disturbing trend that has somehow been normalized now.
Now, to have more insight on the situation in Kashmir, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Khan, the head of diplomatic affairs at Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, there has been a spate of killings of members of minority Hindu and Sikh communities in Kashmir. Now, do you think it's designed to disrupt the centuries-old tradition of communal harmony and religious syncretism in the region?
Hello. Yes, one has to, first of all, condemn this because it is an absolutely not in the interest of the Kashmiri people or the struggle for the right of self-determination in the wider context of the Kashmir issue, Kashmir dispute, Kashmir conflict. This is some kind of orchestrated, sinister move that can be attributed only to those who are in power in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, and particularly in Indian occupied Kashmir. You have something like 900,000 military and paramilitary forces who have practically over the past 2 years laid siege to at least 90% of the population of the Indian occupied Kashmir of state of Jammu and Kashmir. And let's not forget, Kashmir since the 5th of August 2019 has been bifurcated and is directly ruled from New Delhi. There is no local rule in the state of Jammu and Kashmir for almost 26 months now, just over 26 months.
Now, Mr. Khan, in a major crackdown, hundreds of Kashmiri Muslims have been detained in connection with the recent killings. Now, do you agree that the security agencies are looking for a scapegoat?
Of course, there is no legal or moral justification to the Indian government, this government or previous governments, to actually deny the existence and the bona fides of the struggle to right to self-determination in Jammu and Kashmir, because there are around 24 UN resolutions and UN charter demands that the right of the people of Kashmir is sacrosanct and that the Kashmiri people have yet to decide on the future status of their homeland, and therefore the Indian state in particular and in the wider context, those who are occupying the state of Jammu and Kashmir are always looking for excuses and scapegoats. And indeed, the communal dimension of this killing does not serve the interest of the people of state of Jammu and Kashmir, and therefore it has to actually be the answers need to be looked at the occupying forces, the occupying authority, the state that has the power and overwhelming power, unprecedented military occupation in the state of Jammu and Kashmir under Indian occupation is something that cannot be ignored at all.
Mr. Khan, the BJP government in New Delhi claims that the abrogation of Article 370 will bring peace and development to Kashmir. So how do you assess the situation in the region 2 years down the line?
Well, in 1949, the Article 370 was included or created within the Indian Constitution by the Indian state with agreement with the government of Jammu and Kashmir at that time. And the agreement was that India was only responsible for three areas, defense, foreign affairs, and communications. And India has since then actually ingressed into Kashmir and slowly occupied Kashmir and assimilated Kashmir. And abrogation of Article 370 means that since 5th of August 2019, Jammu Kashmir is an independent country occupied or reoccupied by a foreign power. And in clear contradiction of around 24 UN resolutions and also in agreements both between the Kashmiris and Indian state, which was engaged in temporary relationship, and between India and Pakistan. So therefore, India stands a state which is accused of breaking all the rules and all the agreements that it had willingly entered into at the international level and also in the region, and also bilaterally between the Kashmiris and the Indian state over the past 74, 75 years. And therefore, there is no justification whatsoever of the Indian state that it is a matter that it is internal to Indian state. It is not. It is an international issue. And so the excuses from time to time that come from New Delhi is just to reinforce its false and fallacious and also malicious policies against the Kashmiri people.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Khan for his precious time, knowledge and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
India's Congress Party politician Salman Nizami denounces mass arrests in Indian-controlled Kashmir over 7 civilian killings, noting that everyone is not a militant. Muhammad Junaid, political anthropologist, says nobody was arrested when Hindutva mobs lynched people in mainland India, while in Kashmir hundreds were arrested for murders committed by a few.
And that was our episode about the US trying to hoodwink the world through the flimsy promises of aid to Afghanistan and how people in Kashmir are living in fear after recent killings followed by a major crackdown. We shall meet again, same time, same day, next week. So till then, take care.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. For such is the state of the disbelievers, until when death comes to one of them, he says, My Lord, send me back. That I might do righteousness in that which I left behind. No, it is only a word he is saying, and behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the 100th verse of the chapter. وَمِن وَرَائِهِمْ بَرْزَخٌ إِلَى يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ And behind them is a partition until the day when they shall be raised up. In 99th and the 100th verse, talking about the unbelievers, the stubbornness of the pagans and their wrong way, when death comes to one of them, he says, O Lord, send me back again so I can do righteousness. But the Almighty Allah says, no, this is just a simple word that he says, and behind them is a partition. Regarding partition, we have talked through a couple of programs. Concerning the life in Barzakh, we have mentioned a couple of points, but there are some other aspects to be discussed. We have different expressive illustrations mentioned in the different verses of the Holy Quran. One of them is that when a human being dies, his soul will be placed in a subtle body. This body is completely unlike the body of this world, because it is not subject to the accidents that affect the physical body in the world of matter. Since this subtle body is in every other aspect like the worldly body, it is idiomatically called an atom-like body or form. It is neither completely non-material nor it is completely material. It participates in a kind of immateriality of the intermediate world, the life of Barzakh. Some scholars have likened the state of the soul in Barzakh to the state of the soul when a human being is asleep. In that state, when the human being is asleep, the soul may really experience pleasure and pain in an even sharper way than when in the physical state, and it can enjoy a pleasure so much, or can get so upset by a painful experience, that their effects can sometimes be seen on the body itself. The body will smile, the body will cry, or the body might be filled with surprise, or shout in pain. Oh, no.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Some even believe that at the time of sleep, the soul really acts in the atom-like body, and more importantly, some believe that those who have more powerful souls, when they are not asleep, they can also be in the state of non-materiality of the intermediate world while being conscious. This, dear listeners, means that they can leave the body, they can get out of their body, they can travel in this body and be aware of their surroundings and their state, and consciously witness the events, but maybe without being seen. Some of the scholars even specify that an atom-like form exists in every human body. But when a person is going to die and begin the life of the intermediate world, that form leaves the body. Sometimes, as we said, it is possible that in this very material life of the world, it separates from the body, and this is another time that it happens. And even if we do not accept these characteristics of the atom-like body, the main principle cannot be denied, the reality of Barzakh, because it is rationally possible, and it is referred to in many narrations as well, apart from the verses of the Holy Quran that talk about Barzakh explicitly, and many of them yet implicitly. Based on what we said, you may remember that some critics say that the belief in the existence of an atom-like body would necessitate belief in metempsychosis or tanasukh. But we assert that reincarnation is nothing but the transference of one soul into different bodies. The late Sheikh Baha'i, an Islamic great scholar, in response to this criticism, said very clearly that the reincarnation that all Muslims unanimously reject is the rebirth of the soul in another body in this world after the destruction of the body. We will inshallah talk about this aspect of Barzakh more in the next programs. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. best life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Things always worked for me. Worry
ends when faith begins. If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The fifth and sixth and maybe even the seventh Imam, they had a companion named Safwan. Safwan ibn Mihran al-Asadi, but he's known as Safwan al-Jamal. Al-Jamal, as you know, we know when we read the history of this individual, he was a person who had a small business. He had camels, and he used to rent camels out for people who needed to go on a journey. You know, like much like today, you go to Budget or Enterprise to rent a car, and they have a large fleet of cars available. Safwan had a large fleet of camels available. And his job was to rent camels to people who needed them. So one day, what happens? The sixth Imam, Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, comes to Safwan. And he says to Safwan, you know, Safwan, I like you. You're a good Shia. And for an Imam of the Ahlul Bayt to say that he likes you, obviously that's something tremendous. But the sixth Imam says one point. He says, Safwan, I like you. But I have one problem with you. Now, this man must be thinking, what kind of a problem can my imam have with me? The sixth imam says, you know, Safwan, I've got a problem in that you have this business where you rent camels to people, and the problem I have is that you are renting them to Harun, the Abbasid caliph. As we know that after Banu Umayyah, there was a transition period to the Banu Abbas. So Harun is in power, and Safwan is renting his camels to him. The sixth Imam says, I don't like this. This is something which doesn't flow with me. I don't like it. The companion Safwan al-Jamal says to the Imam, Yabna Rasulullah, he says, O son of the Messenger of God, he says, I'm not renting him my camels that he can go and commit sin and murder people. I give the camels to him to rent because he goes for Hajj. And he needs to have, obviously, camels for himself, his entourage, his goods, everything he's carrying. That's why I'm giving him the camels to rent. The sixth Imam says to Safwan, he says, does the caliph pay you in advance, or do you collect your payment when he returns? He says, of course, he pays me when he comes back. I don't take, you know, maybe he takes a deposit, but I get paid when he returns. So the sixth imam says to Safwan, he says, yeah, Safwan. He says, when your camels go and the caliph takes them away and he's going for Hajj, do you make dua? Do you pray that he comes back safely? He says, of course I make dua, because if he doesn't come back, I'm not getting paid. And I probably lose my camels as well. And this is where the imam said, this is the problem that I have. Because you are making prayer, you are making dua for an oppressive leader, a tyrant, an unjust individual. You're praying for him to stay alive till he comes back from the Hajj, because you want your money. And at this point, Safwan basically took a step back and reanalyzed his life and thought about his priorities. Does he want to be beloved by the Imam of Ahlul Bayt and by Allah? Or does he want the dollars? Does he want the gold and silver that the caliph will provide him? Historians say that Safwan sold the entire flock of camels. He got out of the camel renting business. And when the caliph heard about this, he asked Safwan, he says, what happened? I knew that you had this camel business I've rented from you. Why did you all of a sudden sell everything? And Safwan tells him, you know, I'm getting old. I'm having difficulties. My servants can't do the job. So I thought I'd just get out of the business altogether. The caliph was a bit of a shrewd man, a smart man. And he says that, no, you're lying. I know where you got this answer from. It's from your imam. And he says that had I not had respect for you in this history of being, you know, with you, I would have killed you immediately. So this is Safwan, a very noble man, a very trustworthy man. And so we have a hadith from Safwan where he says that Sallaytu khalfa Abi Abdullah alayhi salam ayyaman. I prayed my salat behind the sixth imam ayyaman for many days, for a long time. And he says that every time we prayed the salat, whatever it be, Fajr or Dhuhr or Asr or Maghrib or Isha, every time he would start the salat, he would say loudly, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. And Safwan goes on to say that he would also recite the Bismillah. He says, وَكَانَ يَجْحَرُ فِي السُورَتَيْن جَمِيعًا. That even when he finished the first surah, Al-Fatiha, went to the second surah, he recited the Bismillah. The reason I take you through this event, brothers and sisters, is for us to realize that the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, 12 Imams, look at how long the Imamate lasted, from Amir al-Mu'mineen in 11 Hijri, all the way till the Ghaybah of the 12th Imam, which began in around 320, the major occultation begins. For over 300 years, our 12 Imams governed, they ruled, maybe not by the rule of the people, but they ruled the hearts. They gave fatawa, they gave verdicts on Islam, and they had no difference of opinion. The first Imam and the 12th Imam, the fiqh is the same. The fiqh of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the same that his, you know, his great-grandson would have taught. The same thing his son Imam Al-Kadhim taught. The same his grandson Imam Ar-Radha alayhi salam taught. There's no difference between them. And this is the beauty of Ahlul Bayt, brothers and sisters. They don't take us on different paths. They don't say, you know, we don't say, well, we have 12 Imams, so we have 12 different Islams. No, we have one Islam. Yes, there are certain minor differences in the Ahkam, but there are no major differences in them. This Bismillah, and let me just move on with this, is so important. Give you a story that happened at the time of Muawiyah. You know, we've talked about Muawiyah last night a bit, and we have obviously issues with this individual, and the Prophet also has very clear ahadith about the status of Muawiyah. But one time Muawiyah had made his way to Medina, and he was offering the Jamaat prayers, leading the prayers in Medina, and he did not recite the Bismillah. He started straight with Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim Maliki Yawmiddin, and he finished the Fatiha, did the second surah, finished the Salat. The people of Medina, the companions who were in Medina at that time, there was an uproar in the masjid. They were furious. What did this man do? And the statement that historians quote is, they say, Asarakta, Amnasita, Have you stolen something from us? You've stolen this Bismillah? Or have you forgotten? Did you forget to recite the Bismillah when you started Fatiha and the second surah? The historians say that Muawiyah actually re-read the Salat. He redid that prayer with the Bismillah in place. And scholars offer an explanation here. And they say that perhaps he did this. Well, not perhaps, but he most definitely did this intentionally. Because whatever Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam, used to do, he would do the opposite. And so Imam Ali was known to recite the Bismillah out loud because this is the obligation that the Prophet did. But Muawiyah wanted to ensure that he did not follow in that tradition. And so he did opposite to the Commander of the Faithful.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. The All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani. Stay tuned.
مستحب یادتون باشه جنازه رو که دفن کردین راتون رو نکشید برین چیکار کنین؟ من 6 قدم که رفتین برگرد که این مرده با این قبر انس میگیره.
Remember very well, it is recommended when you have buried the dead, don't go away and leave the grave instantly. After you took a few steps, then come back to the grave, so that the deceased body will become acquainted with the grave. This action is recommended in Islam because the newly deceased body is aware of what is going on. It is aware and it sees. There is a narration which says, if the person who died is a good person, the Almighty Allah addresses this new deceased person and says to them, my servant, have you been left alone? Are the people around you gone? Your wife, your children, your friends? The Almighty Allah says, oh, my servant, they have left you alone. But don't worry, I am your friend now. Lucky are those people who Allah addresses them in this way and tells them, I will be your friend. How nice it is that Allah tells his servant this sentence. What a joy exists in these words told to someone deceased. But if we don't have God by our side and we have no good deeds, then Allah will not address us in this way, and consequently we will be miserable in the grave and all alone.
اما اگر خدا هم ما نداشته باشیم، عمل صالحی نکردیم که خدای حرف رو بزنه، بدبختیم در قبر تک تک.
Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was an English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali and Sayyid Abdullah Musa. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So this series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with an analysis on the important points addressed by the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And in this new series, we are concerned with the topic humans or human beings in the speeches of the leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. For today, we want to talk about an important topic, and that is the difference, or it's better to say the comparison, as it is between the Western democracy and the Islamic one, the term that is coined as Mardom Salariye Dini.
You know, when we talk about democracy in the Western world, the first thing that comes to our mind is a secular political system.
Mm-hmm.
But when we are talking about Islam, this human dignity, you know, has come to the scene. But the case is that now where is the place of rationality in the we can say Islamic system or the system of values. So when we, from one side, if you are going to pay attention to obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with his own system of values, but from the other side, you have these human beings in the 21st century with his system of value and rationality at the top. So what are we going to do with the concept of rationality over here?
Yeah. So I think it's pure rationality that we see in